This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is presented in cooperation with the North Carolina Institute on Blindness. We are continuing with the reading of the book by Judge Craig Brown entitled, A Fork in the Road. Last week we ended with a chapter which described his entering into the legal profession and some of the early cases that he handled. He progresses now into some moments in his early family life. Chapter 7, The Sightless Endgame. To be blind is not miserable, but to be able to bear blindness, that is miserable. John Milton. April 16th, 1989, my first daughter Laura was born. I remember cutting her umbilical cord and sharing the joy of her first cry. For the next month or so, I did the feedings in the middle of the night. Being a proud father, I composed the Laura Song. It was sung to the tune of the Brady Bunch. Her name is Laura. She's so wonderful. And I love her. I love her. It's true. Lady Laura, you are my cupcake. How I love of you. I know. I should keep my day job. The late 1980s not only brought the blessing of a child, I was increasingly plagued with cataracts which impacted my already limited vision. Like sand draining through an hourglass, my eyesight diminished as the cataracts grew. This was not unexpected. Years before, my first ophthalmologist, Dr. John Merritt, had observed that prednisone had no side effects, only known effects. He was right. After taking over 100,000 milligrams of prednisone in the early to mid-1980s, cataract development was an expected side effect. After years of battling Behçet's syndrome, the medication prescribed to Stemmett ultimately led to my first blindness. My doctors were concerned about the surgical trauma caused by cataract removal and artificial lens implants. They had every reason to be, since my left eye alone had hemorrhaged 19 times in the previous decade. Today, cataract surgery and lens implants are a common procedure in most eye clinics. The only question then was whether the risk was worth it. I suggest we do your bad eye first to see if there is a surgical impact, my doctor recommended. That made sense to me. If the operation failed, I would be blinded in the eye in which I was already blind. If it succeeded, all systems were good for cataract removal and implant in my good eye. I agree, I told him. The surgery was an outpatient basis in January of 1990. The surgery and lens implantation went smoothly and without complication. My second cataract removal surgery was in March 1990. Meredith and I were nervous as we drove from our house in southern Durham to Duke Hospital, where the surgery would take place. I checked in promptly at 6 a.m. With the first operation 2 months before under my belt, I knew what to expect. The attending nurse went through the usual checklist. "Have you eaten anything this morning?" she asked me. "No," I replied. "Have you had any problems with your right eye recently?" "No, I have not," I again replied. Her questions continued, and I answered them appropriately. Then she instructed me to lie down on the gurney to begin pre-op. She dabbed the area around the right orbit of my eye with a cotton ball soaked in alcohol to sterilize the area, and then quickly moved me into the operating room. Dr. Kobo greeted me warmly. "Are you all set?" I smiled back at him and said, "I'm as ready as I'm ever going to be." "Good," he said, and made the final preparations for the surgery. He placed my head in a headrest so it would not move during the operation. Then he injected the area around my eye about a dozen times with Novocaine to numb it. With Novocaine to help, I would be conscious during the procedure. A whirring sound filled the room as the computer came up in preparation for the work. Several weeks before, a computer had mapped the complete front structure of my right eye. Cataract surgery was no longer done by hand. It was done with the precision of a computer-guided laser. We waited several minutes while the Novocaine took effect. "Craig, You will now see a light coming towards your right eye. Do not move your eye, Dr. Coble told me. It is a natural human instinct for the eye to flinch when an object comes at it, but after years of eye exams, I had gotten stoically accustomed to it. My eye was motionless as a tiny piece of plastic came to rest on the top of my lens. I felt no pain, only a little pressure. Slowly but surely, the laser guided by the computer mapping of my eye meticulously cut the natural lens from my eyeball. The plastic probe lifted from my eyeball, carrying with it my natural lens clouded by cataracts. Then it all stopped. What's wrong? Barked Dr. Coble to the attending nurses. I could hear several pairs of feet scurrying across the operating room toward the computer. The computer has gone down, a nurse explained. Get the backup computer online now, Dr. Coble ordered. The whirring sound of the computer resumed as a backup was brought online. So much for the wonders of technology, I thought. Hang in there, Craig. It will just be a few minutes. With the backup computer now online, Dr. Coble placed the German artificial lens in position. Unfortunately, by this time, the Novocaine began to wear off. As he began stitching the artificial lens into place, I twitched. Ouch, I complained. That hurt. I know, and I'm sorry, Dr. Coble ventured back, but we will be done in just a few minutes. Tears streamed down my face as he finished the last stitches on the artificial lens. Then he placed a large bandage over the entire eye socket, and it was over. An attendant wheeled me out of the operating room into a post-op. From beginning to end, the entire operation had taken only about 40 minutes. With my good eye covered by the bandage, I was now essentially blind, a precursor of things to come, I mumbled to myself. 20 minutes later, I was back in the waiting room to see my wife and some friends who had come by. My dad, who was now administrator at Duke Hospital, came by to see how I was doing. How are you? He asked. I survived, I grinned back at him. A nurse in the waiting room told me that I was not to engage in any heavy physical activity and to keep my head still. Like a blind guy would be running around, I muttered to myself. Meredith and I went home, and I went to sleep, ever hopeful of sight renewed. The next morning I got up at the usual time, about 7 a.m. Carefully, I groped my way around the master bedroom into the master bath. I was nervous, but excited. It was judgment time. At my surgery the previous day, my doctor had given me permission to remove the bandage the next day, and that day was here. I nervously began to remove the adhesive tape that held the bandage across my right eye. It seemed to take forever. Then the bandage was off. I blinked, once, twice, maybe three times. I looked up, cautiously, into the bathroom mirror before me. Peering through the thin black haze of oxidized blood in my eye, I saw my face clearly for the first time in 2 years. My heart jumped. I can see! I can see! I yelled excitedly. This is incredible! I examined carefully the contours of my face. I have not aged too badly, I thought. I looked up at the beautiful floral wallpaper in the bathroom, mesmerized by the deep red of the rosebuds, the bright yellow background, the dark green leaves, and the curling black rose stems. And I sat there for what seemed like hours, rejoicing in the simple intricacies of the bathroom tile, the embroidered towels, the artful designs on the bathroom curtain, all the interior scenery that sighted people take for granted. I went downstairs to see the rest of my home. As I turned the corner into the dining room, I spotted my 2-year-old daughter, Laura, 20 feet away in the living room. I ran toward her, marveling at how much she had grown and how beautiful she looked. Laura! Daddy can see again! Laura looked at me quizzically. I bent down and she rushed to me. Daddy! I'm so glad! She said simply. We hugged each other in the joy of sight. I walked out the back door of my house and down the long gravel driveway. I turned to take a look at my house clearly for the first time in 2 years. I marveled at the beauty of the pink azaleas up front, the greenness of my grass, the blueness of the sky. The following week, I walked to the courthouse as if nothing had ever happened, as if I had never been blind before. I absorbed the intricacies of every crack in the sidewalk, the face of every friend, the print of any newspaper or magazine. I wanted to shout out to the world, "Eyesight is a wonderful thing. Never, never take it for granted." That weekend, Meredith, Laura, and I went for a drive in our Volvo. Let me put that another way. I drove a car for the first time in more than 5 years. Since I had not had a driver's license in more than 5 years, Meredith drove us to the parking lot of a nearby elementary school. She got out of the driver's seat, and I slid behind the wheel. I drove our car around the parking lot for 20 minutes, talking excitedly about getting my driver's license back now that I could see. The excitement did not last. Within weeks of my surgery, scar tissue formed over the artificial lens, dimming my vision. The problem is not uncommon with young people who receive lens implants. A simple solution: a laser can blast through the scar tissue. I sat nervously in front of the large ruby-red laser at the Duke Eye Center that morning. Dr. Kobo was encouragingly hopeful. "This shouldn't take long, Craig. Sit up and place your chin on the collar," he told me. Dr. Kobo positioned the laser and fired. Once, twice, maybe half a dozen times. There was no pain, just bright light. I sat back as the procedure was completed. "We'll have to wait and see how it looks tomorrow to tell," Dr. Kobo cautioned. Returning to the Duke Eye Center the next morning, Dr. Kobo again examined me. I could see better than before the surgery. However, my vision was not nearly as crisp as the morning after the surgery. Dr. Kobo took a close look at the lens implant and frowned. My heart sank. "What's wrong?" I asked. He sighed. "I'm afraid that the lens has slipped a little bit." "What does that mean?" I asked. "Can it be fixed?" "Maybe. But I don't think it would be worth it," Dr. Kobo told me. "What do you mean?" I asked him. "Craig, you have a larger problem. This surgery is a quick, short-term fix, but you are suffering from optic nerve atrophy. Your optic nerve is dying. Unless that process stops, you will become blind," Dr. Kobo told me, reflecting sadness. Even though the cataract surgeries had temporarily improved my eyesight back to 20/20 in my right eye, there were still problems. I could not see well in bright sunlight, so I wore dark glasses. Once, when I was walking back from the Durham County Courthouse to my law firm, I was wearing my sunglasses on a shaded area of Main Street. It was a beautiful late spring afternoon. Four city workers were standing near a grate on the sidewalk. Since I was wearing sunglasses in a shaded area, I did not notice that the grate was open, nor did the city workers standing there have any idea that I had any eye problems. So the four workers watched me as I fell 4 feet down into an open sidewalk. I lacerated my abdomen and ripped my pants on the gas meter below. I felt stupid and ashamed at my error. It was the first time I had seriously hurt myself because of my impending loss of sight. It surely would not be the last. My eyesight was once again diminishing, but I felt incredibly lucky to have retained some sight at the birth of my second child. As I gazed out the window of the hospital, the little bundle in my arm began to move. I looked down and focused my remaining eyesight on my lovely new second daughter, Susanna. I kept my eyes fixed on her, wanting to memorize every curve, every detail of her face. It was the same thing that I had done with Laura, Susanna's then 3-year-old sister. I found myself watching every moment, every laugh, every breath, never quite getting my fill. I wanted to commit every detail of my girls to memory, from the strands of their hair to the curves of their little smiles. As I studied Susanna's infant face, I felt envious of the other parents in the hospital. They would see their baby's faces not only at the moment of birth, but as they grew and matured over the years, from toddlers to teens to young adults. I was studying Susanna's face as if it were a picture that I could not let escape until I had captured it in my memory. It was a snapshot that would have to hold me for a lifetime. I felt sad and alone. At that moment and many others during Susanna's first 5 years, I was at a crossroads. Would I succumb to my victim feelings? Would I wallow in my sorrow, or would I accept the inevitable? As Susanna nestled in my arms, I realized that I will see my daughters mature over the next 18 years. I will be there with them as they take their first steps, climb their first swing sets, play in their first school concerts, race in their first swimming meets, and learn to drive as teens. I will see them, I told myself. Not in the same way as a sighted parent, but I will see them. When Susanna came home, I took the mid-morning feeding as I had with Laura, changing her diaper as well. Of course, I composed the Susanna song. So, here it goes. This one was sung to the tune of Free Willy. Susanna Brew, how I love you. You are my honey, my bunny, my woo. And yes, I still have my day job. Chemotherapy. It was my last hope for continued sight. It was not a question of if, but merely when. As the years passed, my eyesight continued to diminish. I am a voracious reader, and my reading went from needing normal lighting to requiring special lighting. My vision became increasingly sensitive to glare. At night, I could no longer see at all. The wind came closer. Several weeks after Susanna's birth, I walked into Herb's study. Herb was my father-in-law, a renowned pulmonologist at Duke University. Herb motioned me to sit down, and I ran clumsily into the chair as I did so. Herb turned slowly to me and placed his hand on my shoulder. He looked at me intently, disheartened. I knew what was coming. Craig, he told me, it is time. I know, I replied, tears welling into my eyes. I know. Although medical literature suggests that a virus causes Behçet's syndrome, the definite cause is unknown. Consequently, treatment focuses on the symptoms and on the stopping of the progression of the disease. Chemotherapy is the last battle line for the sick. After 15 years of struggle and survival, I was there. What many healthy people do not understand is that chemotherapy is poison. It has serious, even fatal, long-term effects. For that reason alone, few doctors prescribe chemotherapy to young people unless the benefits outweigh the risks. While past medication had perhaps slowed the progression of my illness, no medication had ever stopped it. The avoidance of chemotherapy, which had dominated my younger years, was no longer possible or realistic. Another thing that few people realize about chemotherapy is that it can severely limit or destroy the ability to procreate. However, I was blessed with two wonderful children, and that emotional argument could no longer carry the day. The drug prescribed to treat my illness was Imuran, which had been around since late 1970s when it was treatment for rheumatoid arthritis. For reasons that doctors did not completely understand, it seemed to have a positive effect in terms of stopping, or at least slowing, the progression of my illness. Depression. Taking chemotherapy did not fit my picture of a 35-year-old, but an ever-dutiful soldier, I did as I was told. I began taking Imuran in May 1992. Its only side effects were plantar warts that covered the entire soles of both feet, which were extremely painful, and the loss of my chest hair. You can learn to live with pain, and I did so for many years. I always hoped that chemotherapy would be the last battle line in my war with Behçet's syndrome. In 1994, law firm rumors began flying about my impending retirement because of the blindness. The rumors were never true, and I responded to them by working ever harder. In 1995, I closed the biggest plaintiff's personal injury case in the Spears firm had ever seen, and directly or indirectly, I accounted for more than $250,000 in attorney's fees that year, which was another firm record at the time. All was not grim. Someone nominated me for North Carolina Lawyer of the Year for my work on TROSA, a 2-year long-term drug rehabilitation facility in Durham. I did not know who nominated me, but Marshall Spears and I were working late on a Sunday afternoon that summer, and Marshall got a phone call from the president of the North Carolina Bar Association informing him of the honor. Marshall was heading out the door when he told me with a big smile on his face. At the time, I did not know I'd been nominated, much less that I had won the award. I was overjoyed hearing this good news. Then Marshall told me that my late father would have been very proud of me, too, just as he was. Marshall looked me directly in the eye. "You won't be here much longer, Craig. Get ready." Marshall was right about that, as he was about most things. He always chose his words very carefully. It took a long time for Kobo's visual death sentence to set in. Perhaps I never believed it then. Certainly, I was good at denying the final reality. I resolved to enjoy the eyesight that I had for however long I had it. But I did not realize until much later how angry and depressed I would become over my impending blindness. In 1990, the timetable for my blindness had not yet been revealed. 2 years later, I was legally blind. 2 years after that, I was functionally blind. It is hard to wait for the inevitable or even to believe that the inevitable will happen. Denial can be a great defense, but it can never deny reality. I always believed that I would be able to see. I still can, but only in different ways. I wish that in my wilderness years, I had shared my heart and my feelings with those people close around me. Instead, in many ways, I withdrew into a fortress siege mentality as I prepared for the final battle. Even though I am blind now, I feel very fortunate for the medical care that I had received. While the doctors could not win the battle against Behçet's, they tried to slow its progression. Instead of having only 3 years of sight left as projected in 1981, it was actually 1995 when I lost my usable sight. Looking back, the intervening years were simply invaluable. I was able to graduate from law school and public policy school on time. Moreover, I was able to cross the experience curve in terms of practicing law, which ultimately led to my judgeship. I am deeply grateful for each of my doctors. Like your own doctors, they are some giants of medicine. Chapter 8. Climb Your Highest Mountain. The most splendid achievement of all is the constant striving to surpass yourself and to be worthy of your own approval. Dennis Waitley. As my eyesight faded, it was important for me to reach the pinnacle of my criminal law career before I went blind. In North Carolina's legal circle, that means defending a capital murder case. I have always been ambivalent about the death penalty. There are a few murderers that deserve it, like the Ted Bundys and the William Gacys of the world, but too many of the defendants sentenced to death are poor, black, and uneducated for my taste. Whether you are disabled, chronically ill, or healthy, it is important to reach for the fence or to climb your own highest mountain. Each of the death penalty cases that I defended had surprising twists or turns in them. The narratives that follow were written shortly after each trial occurred. Ellerick Vaughters. Trying a capital case is the most complex, demanding, and ultimately, if it succeeds, exciting culmination of many years of practice of criminal law. I had been in private practice in Durham since 1983, and my first criminal defense work began shortly thereafter. My first death penalty trial was Ellerick Vaughters' capital murder case. In North Carolina, a criminal defendant charged with capital murder is entitled to two defense attorneys. Since I had no experience in trying capital murder cases, I asked Bill Cotter, a savvy and experienced local defense attorney, to join me in representing Vaughters. I had known Bill in criminal court for many years, and I was attracted by his brash and articulate competence. We agreed that Bill would be responsible for the guilt phase, and I would handle the sentencing phase of the case. In North Carolina, capital trials are broken into the innocent guilt phase first, and then the sentencing phase thereafter. Juries make all decisions as to life or death in this state. I went to visit Vaughters for the first time shortly after I was appointed to the case. I pushed the 7 button on the elevator in the Durham County Courthouse. The county jail at that time was located on the top floor of the county courthouse. I had been there many times over the years. Once the elevator reached the top floor, I stepped out and turned to my right. The jail on the 7th floor was a cold and sterile environment. The air conditioning was running on high. I went to the sheriff's department desk and glanced through the bulletproof plexiglass to locate a deputy so that I could see my client. A deputy approached me at the window. "I need to see Ellerick Vaughters. I represent him," I said. "Take the first booth," the deputy on duty replied. I turned around and walked 15 or so feet to the first interrogation booth. I opened the heavy metal door and walked into the tiny room. I had been here many times before. The booth was maybe 5 by 8 feet, and divided in the center by steel mesh and a plexiglass window. I sat on the metal stool and waited for my client. Ellerick Vaughters was a small black man standing about 5'6" and probably weighing all of 140 pounds soaking wet. From his appearance, he hardly seemed to be the typical murdering type. I introduced myself, and he sat down on the middle chair across from me in the booth. I then reviewed for him the criminal charges he faced: first-degree capital murder, robbery with a dangerous weapon, first-degree kidnapping, and larceny of a motor vehicle. It seemed as if he was in a fog, and was about to learn why. "You understand that any of our conversations are protected by the attorney-client privilege," I advised him. He nodded his head, "Yes." I continued, "So you understand that none of our conversation can be made public?" He nodded again. "So why don't you tell me about it?" I asked him. "I don't remember anything," Vaughters responded. I had asked the same question of many defendants over the years, but this was the first time that one told me that he did not remember what had happened. In some respects, it is the criminal nature. Many defendants never admit responsibility for their crimes and look to their attorneys to get them off. Only when every piece is uncovered, every argument or alibi pursued, do many criminal defendants admit their responsibility. Selective memory loss is a great defense mechanism, but it does not work in a jury situation. I asked him again, "So, what do you remember?" "I don't remember," he said softly. "I was drunk." I was incredulous, and asked myself, how could I prepare a defense in a capital murder case when my client does not even remember anything? It turned out Vaughters was drunk that night. In fact, he was a drunk. At the young age of 24, he was a raging alcoholic, drinking between 14 and 16 quarts of Old English Ale a day. Considering that a quart of Old English Ale is equivalent to, well, at least 2 regular cans of beer with double the alcohol content, you have a good idea of the amount he consumed daily. Given that kind of alcohol consumption, it did not surprise me that he could not remember. Several days later, I met with my co-counsel in the case, Bill Cotter. I repeated to him the substance of my first interview with Waters. What do you mean that he doesn't remember? He doesn't remember anything, I replied. That's a hell of a defense to a death penalty case, Bill sighed. He would be better off pleading guilty. I don't think he's ready for that yet, I responded. I oppose the death penalty in almost all cases, especially when it is my case. Over the next 18 months, Bill and I split up the work on our capital case. Bill took the guilt phase, handling the selection of our psychiatrists, pathologists, and other experts. I was responsible for developing the sentencing phase information, including testimony to back up the many mitigating factors we would put in front of the jury to argue that Waters did not deserve to die. By the time we were finished, Bill and I had each put several hundred hours into the case. But no matter how hard we worked or how much evidence we collected, we still could not get around the simple, brutal facts of the murder. Death penalty cases are never easy, Bill had said. Assistant District Attorney Mike Nifong represented the state in this case. I knew Nifong well. He was a tall, thin, muscular man with dark hair and brown-rimmed glasses, the consummate prosecutor. He had plenty of capital prosecution experience under his belt. He tried a thorough and clean criminal case. Few of his cases were overturned on appeal. Bill and I knew from the outset of the Waters case that it was going to trial. Nevertheless, like any good criminal defense lawyer, we had to ask if a second-degree murder plea was possible. Nifong knew to expect the question, and he had a simple, matter-of-fact answer for us. Not a chance. Only a sentenced jury could save Elric Waters' life now. Like all criminal jury trials, the first step of the trial would be to select the jury. While that is almost as exciting as watching paint dry, it is the most important part of the trial. I will not bore you with the nitty-gritty of jury selection here, other than to say that more than a week later, we finally seated 12 jurors and 3 alternates. After formal entry of Waters' not guilty pleas, I rose and approached the jury to begin our opening statement. At the time of the Waters' trial, I had had about one quarter of my eyesight left. Weeks later, Cotter had warned me, "If you do not tell them," referring to my blindness in the jury, "I will." Cotter was right. It was time. Midway through the opening argument, for the first time, I told the jury that I was mostly blind. I am glad that I did, because during the testimony of Dr. Paige Hudson, I approached the witness stand with an exhibit. But there were 2 white-haired men in my murky field of vision. Instead of handing the exhibit to Dr. Hudson, I handed it to the bailiff, Deputy Milo Crawford, who was standing behind the witness stand. My prior explanation avoided an awkward moment. The evidence presented by the state against Waters was both ugly and overwhelming. The state showed that he and a friend had robbed Richard Burnett of his van at a convenience store in the nearby city of Raleigh. Forcing Burnett into the van at gunpoint, they then stole the vehicle, with one defendant pistol-whipping Burnett in the rear of the van. As they sped down I-40 West, Waters dumped Burnett out of the van on the Fayetteville Street exit ramp in Durham, marched him up the hill, where, with Burnett on his knees and undoubtedly pleading for his life, Waters shot him, execution style, once in the head. The body lay on the ground for 2 hot July days before it was found. You could just imagine its appearance. The photographs of Burnett's bloated body were absolutely horrific. For a brief moment, I was glad that I could not see very well. The facts were clear, and the evidence was brutal. Bill and I both knew that this death penalty case was being lost quickly. For several weeks prior to the trial, Bill had been meeting with our client on a regular basis, trying to convince him that the best strategy to save his life was to plead guilty. In most capital cases, a guilty plea is a very dangerous option, since it cuts off all appeals regarding the jury selection and the guilt phases of the trial. No defendant facing the death penalty in Durham County has ever pled guilty to first-degree murder. Bill and I both felt that a guilty plea was the best option to keep Waters alive and off death row. He was not belligerent in responding to our suggestion of a guilty plea, but he was not interested either. As the trial wore on, Waters began to remember what had happened on the night before the crime occurred. Peering through the haze of his alcohol-clouded memory, he began to see the truth of what had happened and his role in it. As the guilt phase drew to a close, Bill wanted one more time to meet with him privately before we resumed the trial the next day. We agreed to meet the next morning before the trial resumed. I arrived at the courthouse the next morning hopeful, but not persuaded that Waters would change his plea in any way. He had resisted our suggestions for more than a year, so why would he change his mind now? Bill Cotter stepped into the corridor next to the courtroom. As he saw me, he smiled and said, "He'll do it." "What do you mean?" I asked him. "He'll plead guilty," Bill responded, "but he also wants to take the stand." "Take the stand? He'll lose it up there," I retorted. "He wants to admit his responsibility and apologize," Bill replied. "But I don't know what he'll say when he takes the stand. Either we are great lawyers for doing this, or we will look like idiots when it's all over." That was an understatement. We were about to break all the rules in the defense of a capital case. Not only would Waters plead guilty of first-degree murder, he would take the stand during the guilt phase. The case had come down to this. Either he would be on death row, or this would be a Matlock episode. As Waters stood and walked to the witness stand, my stomach was tied in knots. But when Elric Waters took the witness stand, he went there not as a criminal defendant, but as a man ready to admit his responsibility for what had happened. He denied nothing. The prosecutor was incredulous. Never before had Nifong witnessed a defendant in a capital murder case fully admit his guilt. "Are you guilty of first-degree murder?" Nifong asked. "Yes, sir." "Are you guilty of robbery with a dangerous weapon?" Nifong continued. "Yes, sir." "Are you guilty of a first-degree kidnapping?" Nifong asked him. "Yes, sir." And then, for all of his quiet composure, Waters broke down. "I am so sorry, so sorry," he sobbed. The courtroom was hushed as he sobbed on the witness stand, wiping tears from his eyes. But this was no Matlock episode. It was real and awful and painful and glorious all at once. Nifong smiled slightly and said, "No more questions." With evidence of Waters' alcoholism before the jury, the issue of premeditative murder was gone from the state's theory of the case. By pleading guilty to first-degree murder, Waters also removed one of the felony charges as a grossly aggravating factor, since one of those factors had to be used as a factual basis for entry of the plea. All told, it was a risky master stroke if it worked. The jury's verdict the next day said it all. On their first ballot, the jury voted 11-1 for a life sentence. On the second ballot, it was unanimous. Elric Waters saved his own life. Bill Cotter and I were just there. Waters was given a sentence of life imprisonment plus an additional 25 years for first-degree kidnapping. Richard Nelms. Richard Nelms was a tall, muscular black man in his late 20s when I first met him. He was charged with first-degree murder and armed robbery of a convenience store in East Durham, where the convenience store owner, Ricardo Lee, had been killed. The state of North Carolina was seeking the death penalty, and Nelms had previously rejected pleas to second-degree murder and armed robbery that would have left him with life in prison plus 4 years. "I'm not guilty," he glowered at me as we met for the first time. As our conversation progressed, I saw the outlines of a cocky, almost arrogant young man who insisted that he had done nothing. There were no eyewitnesses or videotapes of the armed robbery in the Nelms case, but he had one big and ultimately insurmountable problem in his defense. A bullet from the gun fired by Ricardo Lee at the assailants was removed from Nelms' arm on the day of the shooting. Try as we might, and we tried mightily, we could not get around that fact. Whether Nelms wanted to admit it or not, he was clearly present when the murder occurred. Later, Nelms contended that another person, Robert Lewis, had committed the murder. I was just there, he told me. That was not the last time we heard Nelms' alibi. In legal terms, this is known as the other dude did it defense. In the ensuing months, we could not locate a Robert Lewis. However, Richard Nelms remained entirely convinced of his innocence and refused to accept a plea of any kind. The case would go to trial in January and February of that year. Since I had never tried the guilt phase of a capital murder case before, I sought the services of my colleague Brian Aust to do it. Brian was a tall, thin, blonde-haired man of German descent who had tried many criminal jury trials, both in his private practice and when he was in the public defender's office. Brian's knowledge of the criminal law was substantial. He was thorough in his preparation and inspired in his opening and closing arguments. We worked together well as a team. Once again, we faced our good-natured nemesis, Assistant District Attorney Mike Nifong, who represented the state. Your client really wants a jury trial facing the death penalty? He asked us. I'm afraid so, I told him. As it always is, jury selection in a capital case is tedious and painstaking. During the Vauders capital trial 2.5 years before, I had noticed that Nifong got antsy and tired with the last two seats in the jury box. Lo and behold, he did so again. So, I snuck two black women onto the jury. It took us the better share of a week to select the jury and three alternates. Following the selection of the jurors, the clerk, Lou Constantinou, impaneled the jury. The next step thereafter was for the state to arraign the defendant, which means how the defendant pleads to the various charges against him. How does the defendant plead to the first-degree murder? Nifong asked. Not guilty, Aust responded. How does the defendant plead to robbery with a dangerous weapon? Nifong asked. Not guilty, Aust responded again. The state's evidence began with testimony by the lead detective on the Nelms murder case, crime scene investigator Post. Post was a detective in the New York City Police Department for about 20 years and was finishing his career with the Durham Police Department. The prosecutor introduced the detective to the jury, and his testimony began. From the very beginning, the detective's testimony was uncharacteristically confused. The district attorney asked him the same question 2 times, then 3 times. Still, no good answer. There were 3 murders in 2 days, investigator Post explained. I looked at Aust with a grim smile on my face and whispered, "Unbelievable. Investigator Post has not read his report." Aust smiled back at me. I can't wait for cross-examination. When the state's direct examination of Investigator Post ended 45 minutes later, Nifong's jaw clenched, forming a perfect L down the side of his chin. He was furious. After the trial was over, he would tell us that he had never seen a detective so unprepared in a capital murder case in his entire career. The state's first witness in this capital murder case had been a gift to the defendant. While Aust's cross-examination of Investigator Post was powerful, the case still had one major problem. Ballistics matched the bullet in Nelms' arm with bullets from Lee's gun. Given Nelms' prior criminal history, we could not put him on the witness stand. Since there was no other witness present at the crime scene when the murder occurred, the only evidence that we could offer to explain the bullet in Nelms' arm was in our final argument before the jury. With the state and the defendant having rested, it was time for closing arguments before the guilt phase. Aust stood up and walked quietly before the jury. He argued for about 30 minutes about the weaknesses of the state's case and the state's failure to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. Finally, he explained the bullet in Nelms' arm. Richard Nelms was on the floor trying to avoid the robbery that was occurring in front of him. He was struck in the arm by a deflected bullet from Ricardo Lee's gun, Aust explained to the jury. To be frank, that was about the only explanation we could come up with about how the bullet got there, other than our client was guilty. I ask that you find Richard Nelms not guilty of first-degree murder and robbery with a dangerous weapon, Aust concluded. Mike Niffon was one of the best assistant prosecutors around. I have tried about a half a dozen cases with him, and I'm always amazed at his ability to tie the facts of a defendant's case to fit the state's case and the defendant's guilt. So, Niffon, dressed in a navy blue blazer and cream-colored pants, walked confidently in front of the jury. He said, "I can't believe I'm going to do this." Then he flopped onto the floor and mimicked how the defendant said he had been shot. In the span of 30 seconds on the courtroom floor, Niffon completely destroyed our defense. After the trial was over, I told him that that was the only time I'd ever put him on the floor. We both laughed. The jury came back in about 6 hours and convicted Richard Nelms of first-degree murder and armed robbery. While not unexpected, Aus and I were a little surprised by the speed of the jury's verdict. But we were confident of a life sentence since we had about 3 days of psychiatric and other testimony to present to the jury during the sentencing phase. As we walked out, even Niffon considered that it was probably a life case. As we left the courtroom, we went upstairs to the Durham County Jail to visit our client. We found Richard Nelms no longer cocky and arrogant. Rather, he was cold, remote, and distant. He gave us an evil look. We again explained the next process in the case, the sentencing phase, and he nodded in understanding. As we got into the elevator, I said, "Let's try to save his life." Both of us spent most of the intervening weekend in our offices preparing for the sentencing phase. Neither of us was prepared for the surprise ending. When we got back to the courtroom the following Monday morning, the air was abuzz with rumors. A sheriff's deputy approached us, laughing. "Your client tried to escape last night." "If you are kidding, that's not funny," Aus growled at the deputy. As it turned out, on Sunday morning before the trial, Nelms had placed a 4-inch metal shank in the sole of his shoe, faked an injury in the jail shower, placed blue pants underneath his orange jumpsuit, and almost got out of the courthouse before he was strip-searched. "The only thing we can do now is to eliminate all positive character evidence from mitigating factors," I told Aus. In the aftermath of our client's attempted escape, we absolutely had to keep all evidence of his attempt from being put in front of the jury. If a jury knew that, the likelihood of a death sentence would be vastly increased. The only way to keep it out was not to include any positive character evidence. Assistant District Attorney Niffon did not have to agree to our striking more than 30 mitigating factors to avoid putting evidence of Nelms' escape attempt before the jury. But he agreed to do so with a grim smile on his face. Nelms came down to the courtroom surrounded by a group of sheriff's deputies. A leg iron had been placed on his right leg. We explained to him the consequences of his attempted escape. I didn't know, he repeated several times. "Why don't you let us be the lawyers in your case?" Al shot back at him. I slowly went through each of our 45-plus mitigating factors, eliminating those that had made any positive reference to Nelms' character. By the time we were done half an hour later, his 40-plus mitigating factors had been cut in half. In fact, he now only had 2 mitigating factors, that he was crazy, a trait which can be attributed to most murderers, and that he had had a bad life, which probably half of the jury had. What followed was the weakest sentencing phase evidence that I have ever put before a jury. The jurors were a little befuddled and somewhat confused. They did not understand why we did not put on more of a sentencing phase. Suddenly, in almost an instant, a life sentence case had been transformed radically into a real death penalty case. Fortunately, Nelms' great-aunt, dressed in white and riding a white scooter, made an impassioned plea for her nephew's life. His cousin did the same thing. Niffon was cold and intense when he rose for the state's final argument. "Richard Nelms stole money and murdered Ricardo Lee. There is no colder type of murder. He deserves the death penalty." When I rose to speak to the jury, a pit welled up in my stomach. I was angry with my client for his stupidity and for the circumstances that we now faced. This is nothing but a convenience store murder, plain and simple, I told the jury. I could feel their collective heat of disgust about that argument. I abandoned it quickly. What kind of community have we become if we sentence every murderer to death? I asked the jury. I called upon them to use their sense of compassion, mercy, and fairness, and to sentence Richard Nelms to life in prison. I sat down. I was exhausted and spent. After the jury was sent out to deliberate, Alice and I spoke with one of the alternates in the hallway. I can't believe how little evidence you put on in the sentencing phase, she told us. We explained that Richard Nelms had attempted to escape from the jail the night before the sentencing phase had begun. You're kidding, she looked at us in disbelief. Well, no wonder. If that evidence had gotten in front of the jury, he would have been sentenced to death in a heartbeat. We knew that, and hence our strategy. Being present in the court for a jury verdict in a capital murder case is about as intense as the practice of law can ever be. The stakes are so high. The jury knocked on the jury door to indicate a verdict. Your Honor, the jury has a verdict, the bailiff said. Bring the jury in, Superior Court Judge Orlando F. Hudson, Jr. said. One by one, the jurors filed in and took their seats in the jury box. As they filed in, I turned to my legal assistant, Sharon Gitton, and quietly asked her, Are the jurors looking at us? No, she replied. I began to sweat the sweat of a man in fear. Years of experience in psychology told me that jurors that sentence a defendant to death do not look in the direction of the defendant when they enter the courtroom. I steeled myself for the big hit. Does the jury have a unanimous verdict? Judge Hudson asked. No, Your Honor, we do not, the foreperson responded. A great and collective sigh of relief rose from the defense table. In North Carolina, a death sentence requires a unanimous jury verdict. Since the jury verdict was not unanimous, Richard Nelms would be sentenced to life imprisonment. Shortly after the verdict, Judge Hudson polled each member juror to determine how each voted. The final vote was 10-2 in favor of a death sentence. The two jurors who had voted for life were the last two jurors seated on the jury. While the jury selection may be like watching paint dry, this case was won in jury selection. We were exhausted and overjoyed. Despite the best efforts of Richard Nelms to the contrary, he narrowly avoided the death penalty. It is thanks to the skill of his trial counsel that no evidence of his attempted escape went before the jury, which is the only reason he did not get the death penalty. Or, as a lawyer friend told me the following day, You all got a good look at the hangman, I guess. Yes, I replied, but the hangman blinked. The message of the Waters and Nelms cases is simply to do your best under any circumstances, even though you cannot control all of the events. That message applies regardless of your occupation, your job, your profession, or your physical disability. If you are not able to work because of your medical issues, you should challenge yourself in other ways. If you cannot walk, try taking your first step. If you cannot speak, try your first word. The most important thing is to try your best and to do the very best you can. My second wife, Catherine Costantino, was a lawyer as well, attractive and full of energy. She helped me with my judicial career and raising my two daughters as well, all of which I appreciate to this day. Catherine and I joined with two other couples to climb Roan Mountain, which is the second highest peak in the state of North Carolina. No one was really sure that a blind man could do it, and neither was I. We began our ascent on the Appalachian Trail, then climbed a 60-degree rock face to reach a long plateau before the steep climb. As I climbed on my hands and knees up the rock face, several sighted climbers offered to carry me the rest of the way, but I declined. I was going to make this climb on my own, one way or another. It took me a while, but I made it. Several hurricanes skirted the North Carolina mountains earlier that September. so the trail was well marked and easy to follow. It took me about twice as long to climb to the top, but I made it. On the top of Roan Mountains, you can see for miles. We pitched camp, made supper, and settled down for a cool fall night. It was quite an adventure. You do not have to literally climb a mountain. You may not want to, or you may not be able to. Whatever your situation, always challenge yourself in a manner that helps you to move forward. Good luck on climbing your mountain, whatever that may be. Chapter 9, Some Giants of Medicine. Listen to advice and accept instruction. In the end, you will be wise. Proverbs 19:20. All chronically ill people need a health care team in their local medical center, hospital, or doctor's office, depending upon the size or scope of their particular medical issues. The nature and training of each team's doctors is determined by the medical care problems of each patient across multiple specialties within the field of medicine. As far and as long as possible, every patient, especially a chronically ill patient, needs to maintain the same doctors whenever possible. I have seen some of my doctors for as long as 25 years, so they have become very familiar with my medical history. In my own case, starting with many different Behçet symptoms in 1976, I have had a lot of doctors, far too many for somebody the age of 53, but you absolutely have to deal with the cards you have been dealt. There are only 15,000 to 20,000 cases of Behçets in the United States. For that reason, I often got the chairman of every medical specialty. With a rare disease like Behçet syndrome, there is little available funding for research. There's no medical cause and no known cure, even today, with all the medical advancements over the 34 years of my battle. So I call myself a medical zebra. I am a weird case that sparks the curiosity of some of the best doctors I have dealt with over the years. Of course, I am lucky. I have had good medical insurance for my entire life. Just imagine a rare chronic case like mine with no health insurance. 50 million Americans do not have health insurance. As an American with a chronic health condition, I think it is critically important that we have national health care for everyone, no exceptions. Most Republicans do not support national health care, but they fought Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, too. If I had had to battle Behçet's without the benefit of a health care policy, I would be dead. Like many college and university students, my first line of defense when the symptoms began was the student health service at UNC Chapel Hill. I still tried to see the same doctor every time. The student health service doctors could never identify what initially caused my throat ulcers in 1976 and 1977, much less the different symptoms that appeared after that. Fortunately, my student health service doctor was intensely curious about what was causing my health problems. Through some extensive medical research, he even identified Behçet's syndrome as a potential cause before my case was transferred to doctors at North Carolina Memorial Hospital. He was a good doctor. He made the right call early, years before it was finally and formally identified in 1979. He told me once he certainly hoped that I did not have Behçet syndrome.
This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is prepared in cooperation with the North Carolina Institute on Blindness. We will be back next week with a continuation of A Fork in the Road by Craig Brown.